The time is 7:19 a.m. My hand grasped the handle of the camera and I set my teeth. My whole mind was concentrated upon my work. Another 30 seconds passed. I started turning the handle. 2 revolutions per second. No more, no less. I noticed how regular I was turning. I fixed my eyes on the readout. Any second now. Surely it was time. It seemed to me as if I'd been turning for hours. Great heavens. Surely it had not misfired. Why doesn't it go up? But then it happened. The ground where I stood gave a mighty convulsion. It rocked and swayed. I gripped hold of my tripod to steady myself. Then, for all the world like a gigantic sponge, the earth rose into the air to the height of hundreds of feet. Higher and higher it rose, and with a horrible grinding roar, the earth fell back upon itself, leaving in its place a mountain of smoke. From the moment the mine went up, my feelings changed. The crisis was over, and from that second, I was cold, cool and calculating. I looked upon all that followed from the purely pictorial point of view, and even felt annoyed if a shell burst outside the range of my camera. Why couldn't Bosch put that shell a little nearer? It would make a better picture, and so my thoughts ran on. The earth was down. I swung my camera round onto our parapets. The engineers were swarming over the top and streaming along the skyline. Our guns redoubled their fire. The Germans then started high-explosive shrapnel, began falling in the midst of our advancing men. I continued to turn the handle of my camera, viewing the whole attack through my viewfinder, first swinging one way and then the other. Then another signal ran out, and from the trenches immediately in front of me, our wonderful troops went over the top. And what a picture it was. They went over as one man. I could see while I was exposing that numbers were shot down before they reached the top of the parapet, others just the other side. They went across the ground in swarms, and marvel upon marvels, still smoking cigarettes. One man actually stopped in the middle of no man's land to light up again. These were the words written by a man called Geoffrey Malins, who'd been appointed by the War Office to record the opening scenes of the Battle of the Somme on the 1st of July 1916, and Malins was situated just behind the British front line near the village of Beaumont-Hamel. And anyone who's listening to this podcast will be familiar with the footage that he captured on that morning, because as far as we know, this was the first film that anyone had taken of British troops going into combat. Because shortly after the mine exploded, which of course is in the film, you can see the British soldiers moving across no man's land. And then the film is cut because he ran out of film. And by the time he put a new film in, you can see some of those soldiers retreating across no man's land. And indeed, some of them are falling to the ground. Malins continued with his report of what happened. He said that the Germans had by now realised that the great attack had come. Shrapnel poured into our trenches with the object of keeping our supports from coming up. They even got their crumps and high explosive shrapnel into the middle of our boys before they were halfway across no man's land. But still they kept on. Shells were exploding quite close to me. The first lot of men, or rather the remainder of the men, had disappeared into the haze and smoke, punctured by bursting shells. Still more men went over, and still a stream of men were making for the mine crater. And then they disappeared into the smoke. The noise was terrific. Our men had ceased to flow from our trenches. I crept to the top of the parapet and looked towards the left of the village of Beaumont-Hamel. Our guns were bursting on the other side of the village, but I could distinguish nothing else as to how things were going. On the other side of No Man's Land was the 119th German Regiment, and they bore the brunt of the Hawthorne mine. And this is what one of the survivors wrote about what happened. He said, during the intense bombardment, there was a terrific explosion, which for the moment completely drowned the thunder of the artillery. A great cloud of smoke rose up from the trenches of No. 9 Company, followed by a tremendous shower of stones, which seemed to fall from the sky all over our position. More than 3 sections of No. 9 Company were blown into the air, and the numbering dugouts were broken and blocked. Ground all around was white with the debris of chalk, as though it had been snowing, and a gigantic crater over 50 yards in diameter and some 60 feet deep gaped like an open wound in the side of the hill. And he went on, he said the explosion was a signal for the infantry attack, and everyone got ready and stood on the lower steps of the dugouts, rifle in hand, waiting for the bombardment to lift. In a few minutes the shelling ceased, and we rushed up the steps and out of our crater positions. Ahead of us, wave after wave of British troops were crawling out of their trenches and coming forwards towards us at a walk, their bayonets glistening in the sun. So welcome to another edition of my podcast. My name is Terry Wenham, and I call this podcast Tales from the Battlefields. And this week I wanted to focus on the Hawthorne Crater at Beaumont Hamel. And the reason I read those accounts was by way of an introduction. Anyone who's been to the Somme will, of course, been to Loch Nagar Crater, but sometimes the Hawthorne Crater is missed. And it's an area that has been changed quite a lot over the last 4 or 5 years since the Hawthorne Ridge Crater Association was established. And in this week's episode, we're going to talk to the UK Secretary of the HRCA, a man called Rick Smith, and he's going to talk to us about how the association was established, why they established it, the work that's gone on, and how people can get involved and visit the crater. Now, what a lot of people don't realise until they see the exposed craters that are there now is that it's not just one crater, but it's a double crater, because by the end of October 1916, a new chamber, which was 200 feet south of the original mine, was charged with £30,000 worth of explosives. And after a variety of delays, the attack in November was staged by the 51st, the Scottish Highland Division, on the 13th of November. Now, they'd learnt from their mistakes from 5 months earlier. This time the mine was blown at 5:45, and it was before dawn and in thick fog. This time there was no photography or filming, but the mine explosion was in fact a complete success. The new mine crater collapsed the southern side of the existing crater, and many of its defenders must have been killed by this blast. And this second mine was smaller but slightly deeper. The crater had steeper sides than the original one, and its force swept a large segment of the eastern side of the position away, and it created a roughly triangular shaped feature that we see today. And this battle was really the end of the Battle of the Somme, and the Hawthorne Ridge was taken that day by the 51st Highland Division, and the ridge remained in British hands until it was recaptured by the Germans in their spring offensive in 1918. So that's enough for me. Let's now see what Rick had to say when I spoke to him from his home in Yorkshire a few days ago. So tonight we're on recording on Zoom, but I'm talking to Rick Smith, who's a Yorkshireman. And Rick is the secretary, is that right, of the Hawthorne Ridge Crater Association.
Yeah, the UK secretary, yeah, UK to make me full title, yeah.
A French arm as well, isn't there, Rick?
There is indeed, yeah.
So what do we want to talk about tonight was obviously the history of the Hawthorne Crater, which will be familiar to anybody that's been to the Somme. You can't really go to the Somme without visiting the Hawthorne Crater. But in years gone by, that was always quite a challenge, climbing up to the Hawthorne Crater from the Beaumont Road. But that's been access to it has been improved during the last few years because of the association. So we're going to talk about that. Wanted to talk about exactly what happened at Beaumont Hamel and the Hawthorne Crater, not just on the 1st of July, but in November of 1916. But before we go any further, Rick, tell us, how did you get your passion for the Great War?
How did I get my passion? Right, I have to go back to, I was probably 6 or 7 years old, was what I can remember, so way back. I won't give it away and show my age, but it was my grandfather. My grandfather served along with his two brothers, my two great uncles. All three served, all three survived, all three were wounded in some way, shape or form. And as a youngster, it was my father and my mum's, but my father mainly, his passion was the Great War.
So this was your dad's dad and two uncles.
That's correct, yeah. So I knew my grandfather until I was 10 years old.
I did. I was going to say, did you know him? Yeah.
Yeah, but it was a grandfather. I didn't.
We were too young, weren't we? We were too young to ask questions at that stage.
Absolutely, I didn't know him as a guy who'd served in the war. I knew he had, and I saw photos of him, and he didn't really talk about it. No. But not in a sort of depressing sort of, I don't want to speak, was so horrible sort of, I don't want to talk about it. He just wasn't particularly interested in talking about it.
It was gone.
It was just gone. He used to, the one thing I remember about him and his link to the First World War was the odd story. And he used to sing songs. He used to sing me the songs, you know, like you do to your grandkids and bouncing them on your knee and all that. And his song that he did that to was, you know, Oops, There Goes a Whiz Bang or something like that, you know. So I remember him as that.
Was he an artillery man then, your granddad?
He was, yeah. Yeah, Royal Field Artillery, yeah.
Field Artillery, right.
Yeah. Well, initially Field Artillery. He joined up in, well, he attested in November 15.
Yeah.
He joined up. He went up to Newcastle in January 16.
So he's still been a volunteer in November 15, was he?
Yeah, I think he'd done it. It was the Derby scheme was on. Yeah. It was in the brief period the Derby scheme was on. So he got his name down. Never fully knew why he was in the field artillery. I think they probably directed him that way because of his background and his work skills. And he was from farming stock.
Yeah,
so he knew horses,
and
he worked in a mill, so he knew machinery.
Yeah, guns were a machine, weren't they?
Yeah, his older brother was a territorial in the 1st, 4th Dukes, so you'd have thought potentially he'd have just joined the Dukes because his brother was in it, but he didn't. Yeah. He ended up in the artillery.
Well, wouldn't that be November 15 that they'd already started to pick up lots of casualties from the early months of the war, and the option of choosing which regiment you went into was disappearing? Maybe at that stage.
Yeah, absolutely. I honestly think it was he had the option based on his experience. He just qualified, if you like to call it, in his apprenticeship in the mill. He turned 20 at Christmas, so he attested before it. Turned 20, finished his apprenticeship, and then he went straight away in the new year up to Newcastle.
He was from Yorkshire.
Yeah. He signed up in Halifax,
right?
But to the RFA.
Yeah.
Went to Newcastle, and then he did his training there for 3-4 months.
Yeah.
Then he headed down south. He was around Ipswich and Folkestone and the south coast for a couple of weeks, waiting to know where they were going. He thought he was going to go somewhere like the Middle East or something like that, because he got the inoculations,
right?
And he got warm weather kit issued, and then within a week of that they changed and he was on a boat to France.
When was that? In 16?
In April 16.
So just in time for the Battle of the Somme?
Yes, yeah. He went straight to the Somme, pretty much. Yeah. He was a trained gunner by then. He'd done his qualification as a gunner. He was listed as a gunner. But he actually went into ammunition column. He went into an ammunition park.
Yeah.
So he was working out of that, because every ammunition column had to have a number of trained gunners with the ammunition.
Yeah.
You know, it was Army Service Corps guys that were driving the trucks or whatever that was getting it to the front line, but they didn't know the ammunition. And the gunners did. So he used to go. He worked in the park, but he used to be on columns, taking it up to, you know, the piles of ammunition up to the front.
So would he been one of those gunners that was involved in bombarding the German trenches in the week before the 1st of July?
He wasn't actually on the guns, no. He was supplying. He was on supply column.
Yeah.
And also
the guns for that bombardment.
Yeah. And he was also seconded, him and a bunch of guys from the park, were actually seconded to a siege battery to dig positions for them.
Oh, really?
The 25th Siege Battery, yeah.
Yeah.
They were down in 13 Corps area, down Suzanne area. Yeah. So he was down there for 6 or 7 weeks, digging positions, digging dugouts for the gunners, digging observation posts up in the front line. So he was kind of in the thick of it.
Yeah.
And he I'm fortunate enough to have his diaries. The actual diaries that he passed on to my dad, and my dad passed to me. And he mentions
did you
in
know,
there.
When you were a child, did you know that he'd got these, he'd written these diaries?
Probably not until I was into well into my teens,
yeah,
late teens.
Yeah.
And because I used to go, we used to go on family holidays, to the Western Front, from being 7 years old.
Because your dad had that passion.
He had that passion. And he took, you know, my mum and dad and me and my sister, my older sister, and we'd go to the coast, we'd go to the seaside for a week, have a regular holiday, and then spend the next week working his way back up through the Somme and up to Ypres and what have you. So I've been on those battlefields for 50 years.
Great memories, aren't they? Great memories.
Oh, yeah. So it's kind of, I always say this to people, it's different with me. I haven't learned it. It's just become part of me. It's always been there, you know.
Yeah, I think it was with me. With my granddad, you know, he was in the Royal Garrison Artillery. Story similar to your granddad, and I knew him. I was nine when he died. But for me, for 20 odd years, that information, no, more than that, for 30 odd years, that information I had was dormant. It was away. You know, I was busy doing business and doing other things. Whereas you, it's been with you all the way through your life, hasn't it?
Yeah. My father just took it on, and he'd been doing it, and I just went with him. And then, you know, he passed it on, and then when he got older, he passed the baton on. We had one last trip out, just the two of us, and followed his diary for a week.
We did
each year of his diary as best we could, so that we could, you know, when my dad was in his late 70s, getting on for 80, he knew he wasn't going to be able to do it much time. So we did it together. And
well, you're never going to forget that, are you? That week?
No. Recorded it all. It's on a video. It's
brilliant.
You know, documented. So
so
that's kind of me, and I've just carried it on. It's just become part of my makeup, and all I want to do is the same thing, you know.
Yeah,
I'm fascinated by the subject.
So you're fascinated by the battlefields, but also because of your grandfather's connection with the RFA, you've always been interested in the artillery men. But then, how did you make that jump to getting involved with what's now called the Thorn Ridge Crater Association? How did all that come about, and how did you meet the lunatics?
Well, I got a phone call. A chap called Derek Bird. You may have heard of him, Dickie Bird. He runs the North of Scotland branch of the Western Front Association.
Okay.
And he was an old friend of my father's. When my dad and mum retired, they retired to the North of Scotland. And my dad set up the North of Scotland branch. He'd already set up the Yorkshire branch, the West Yorkshire branch, way back in the 80s. And when he moved up, he set that one. And he met Dickie, and Dickie became a really good friend. Dickie was ex-RAF. And a chap got in touch with Dickie and said, do you know anybody that would be interested in working on this project? Dickie was going to be part of it as well, who has any sort of other experience. This is what we want to do. Has he any other experience, as well as interest in the First World War, that would help with the project that we want to take on? I've got Andy Robertshaw interested. So he said, I know just the fella. He's a landscaper. He's a gardener and landscaper. But also that's my profession. But he has a big history in the study of the First World War. Now Dickie's heavily involved in Beaumont Hamel. He was the chap who got the flagpole reinstated.
And in the village.
And the memorial to the 51st Highland Division. And has written a book on the subject as well. So he put me in touch. The chap that got in touch with me then was a chap called Nigel Fagg. Who is now our president. And he had friends in the village. He'd been meeting with friends in Beaumont Hamel for a number of years. And they used to do a bit similar to what you do with the charity walk. They used to do bi-yearly. They used to do a charity walk between Somme and Ypres for fundraiser. And he got in really well with some of the locals in the village. And he was quite new to the subject. And they sort of introduced him to the craters, because one of the chaps who we became friends with was one of the landowners. And
if I remember right, what you told me before, the crater was owned by several different farmers. Is that right?
Yeah, five different landowners just owned the area of the crater. You can imagine that. It's some of the French landowner laws are just unbelievable, as we found out over the ensuing years of trying to sort this out. Mm. And Nigel sort of took it on and said, you know, something needs to be done about this place. It's just, you know, it's in a state. It's an absolute, and it's going to potentially, we're going to lose it, you know, because the way things have been disappearing across the Western Front battlefields, and understandably, it's their land. You know, I can totally understand it, but this being such an iconic site, as we like to think, and I think most people do, the more we sort of enlighten people about it and teach and share about it.
Well, it's a beacon, isn't it? Because wherever you are, when you're at Newfoundland Park or to the north up on the Reader, wherever you are in there, you can point to it and say that cluster of trees is the Hawthorne Crater. You've always been able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a lot closer to places than you think as well. You forget just how near it is to everything. Mm. And I mean, you find that a lot on the Somme front, you know. Mm. They say it's an 18-mile front, but it's not that big when you get there. Everything is very close together.
You were saying to me off air that the guys that were involved, you didn't know them. You knew Dane, but you didn't know the others.
Yeah, that's correct. I got a call from Nigel, and I remember it plain as day because it was on Armistice Sunday.
Yeah.
2017. I'd just been to the service and a local service, and he phoned me and said, can you get to the Somme right at the beginning of January? We're meeting up. I've got a team of guys together. Can you come out and be there and be part of this new venture to hopefully save Hawthorne Ridge Crater?
Right.
I said, yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So I did. I turned up, I drove out there, I parked up on the sunken lane, walked up to the top of the hill, and that was the first time I met everybody. So there was Andy Robertshaw was there. Then there was Terry Berry, who is now our chairman. Colin Wynne, who is a founder. Colin's had years of experience working on the battlefields and giving tours around the battlefields. Worked on various projects. Glory Hole, the Vampire Dugout, the Flame Projector at Mametz. He's a ex-engineer, not a forces engineer, but a military engineer. A couple of other guys that were there and two or three of the locals. That's where it all began, basically.
The attraction is bringing that team together, looking at those. You've got a builder, you've got an engineer, landscape gardener, and then you've got Dane who came along as an archaeologist. So you've got the skills, didn't you, and the experience that they were looking for.
Yeah, it was to pull it all together. And so it was having the general interest in the Great War and the site and its position and everything about it, but bringing things to the table, our own skills, to help not develop the site, because we're not developing it, we're just making it visitable and accessible.
I think
there was a lot of things to do, you know. There's a lot to
passion.
Do.
It's more than an interest.
That's it. 100%. I mean when we met there, you could, as you will know, you could hardly see your hand in front of your face in it. Was just so overgrown, it was full of junk, it was full of rubbish and
the builder's rubble and stuff. Biggest challenge, if you came to it from the Beaumont Road, was actually climbing up there.
A
very steep hill with no path.
Yeah, the path was practically non-existent. Well, it was a man-made path just by people walking up it. It was the edge of a field.
Very steep.
There were half a dozen steps at the bottom that left a lot to be desired. An upper steep, slippy bank up a field. And when you got there, it was just a big hole full of trees and scrub and brush and, like I say, junk and rubbish and farmer's waste and all sorts of stuff.
So the first objective was to save it from being filled in, from being backfilled. And the second objective then was to try and maintain it and improve it, but not clear it. You didn't want to clear it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what Nigel had to do previous to this meeting for 18 months, he had been getting the locals on board to do something about it, and also the local area. So that's like the the commune of Albert. It was it's within the commune of Albert. So the local mayor of Albert. By having discussions with them and then getting these five landowners around a table, two of which were brothers who hadn't spoken to each other for 20 years. And it was just the bane of their life, really. It was just a place, but they owned it. So Nigel managed to get an agreement between the local commune of Albert, the mayor there, to buy their share from them for a nominal per square metre, to work out how much square metres each landowner owned. Right. And they got a certain amount.
Yeah. So it was
by commune of Albert. And then they leased it to us as a charity association. So we now have a 99-year lease on the site. They gave us a little bit of land so that we could just expand the path around it. And one of the key things to saving this site is to try and keep it as is as much as possible. So there was a bit of, I won't say upset, but issue with one or two people at the beginning, concerns. He's out. We had to take a lot of scrub out.
Because I think I remember dying, saying, a lot of the trees were dead, weren't they, or were dying?
They were dead or dying or diseased, and potentially they were going to come down anyway.
Yeah.
So and if we were going to have people visiting that, we want to try and keep it as safe as possible. It's a battlefield site, and it's a natural battlefield site, so there is amount of you go there at your own risk, but it is a lot smaller than it used to be. A load of the brush out, which opened up a whole new view of it, of what was in there. Almost immediately we were clearing it, because especially having an archaeologist on site, he was spotting things instantly. And you know, just clear that bit. I think I know what's that. I know what that is. And it opened so many new avenues of research. Well, it just every time we go, it does that, to be honest. Every time we go, it throws up another little another grenade into, pardon the pun, but another thing that we find out every time. There's so much there and so much still to find out.
Have you found the entrance to the tunnel then that the Royal Engineers used?
No, I have an idea of roughly where it might be. The one thing we haven't got is the Royal Engineers map. There is one for Loch Na Garr. But we haven't found the one for Hawthorne. There are sketches, there are rough diagrams, there are rough from the tunnelling company diagrams, but they are not fully accurate. It is, but we know roughly where it is.
And did they use the same tunnel for the November explosion?
They did, yeah. 75-85% of it. And then same shaft, same initial tunnel to where they blocked it off, where they tamped it for the explosive for the first blow. And they got up to that, they cleared any damage up to that point, and then they went and dug the second charge.
So what's going to happen? I mean, lots of people that will be listening to this will have been to the crater. They'll have seen the incredible work that's been carried out over the last few years. What's next for the crater then? What are you going to do next?
We're just kind of taking it a year at a time. We'd like to do, we've done a little bit of archaeology on it, but it is very small, non-invasive as far as it can be. Yeah. And all archaeology is invasive because you're digging into the ground, we're only cleaning up a couple of areas to try and learn what these were. We're not looking for things. We're not looking for casualties. We're not looking for battlefield artifacts.
No.
We're looking to find out how it was used throughout the remaining year of the war. It wasn't just a 1st of July blow. It wasn't then a 13th of November blow. It was occupied in those four times. So we want to find out how they occupied it, why they did, what they did it for, the Germans used it for, because you would do, you know, when we blew it on the 1st of July, we didn't capture it. They have instantly got a site to use that is protected on top of a ridge. They're going to do something with it. So they're going to fortify it to a point, going to cut observation posts in it. They're going to put machine gun positions in it. Did they tunnel into it from Beaumont Amble? Possibly. We'd like to do a bit of archaeology on the German side, the German lips, or the Beaumont Hamel side, to see how the German front lines into the original redoubt that we first targeted blew, and then how they then fed into it when it was a crater. So there's all these little questions that need answering with south. So you're looking initially at the first crater and then the second blow to the back, sort of half right. The left-hand side is a lot shallower. It's fully, it's cratered. It's shell cratered. And that has to be 1918 British artillery damage that's blown the side out.
Because they wouldn't have been hitting it with, because obviously the Germans withdrew from there in the spring of 1917. So wouldn't
they
have
came out then, we went through, we held it, and then it became somewhere in the back areas. And then in March and into April 18, March into April 1918, the Germans return and basically take up the same positions.
So in terms of casualties, presumably they'll have all been cleared anyway.
Yes, you would have thought so. I mean, the initial, there were only 38, I'm not exactly sure, 38 around German casualties from the first blow. Obviously, there were casualties within the fighting from the edge of it, but from the actual detonation, and there'd be nothing there.
No.
You know, if you're in that area and that goes off, you're not going to find anything.
No, that's right.
And similarly in November.
Yeah.
Because they would have occupied the first crater, but the second crater blew to the side.
Yeah.
And it would have taken out anybody in the first crater.
Yeah, of course it would, yeah. Yeah,
because they were blowing a second mine next to a big hole, so it'll have blown sideways. So anybody that was in the first one again would have just disappeared. So there is possible, you know, casualties would have been removed from each blow afterwards. Then you get nothing. You get nothing for a year.
Mm.
It's getting overgrown. You know, the trenches have been overgrown again. Mm. It would have sort of becoming overgrown again. And then the Germans return again at the end of March, beginning of April 1918.
Mm.
They try to push further through, but they get stopped again on the edge of Ocean Billers. They don't get to Ocean Billers again. Mm-hmm. So they just go back to their original positions, more or less.
In the same places where they were for 2 years, 14 to 16.
Except they had the sunken lane this time. They occupied the sunken lane and it was a little bit altered, but pretty much the same.
Pretty much the same. That's incredible.
So then from then until August 1918, they were in occupation again.
Mm.
But we would have been shelling them and raiding them and tunnelling to them and sapping to them and all that, and doing trench raids and all that, as they had done pre-July 16.
Different people.
And then in August, late August, we sweep through again. And it's back in our hands again.
And so do we know anything about any of the German soldiers, the individual soldiers that were killed or fought in that area? I'm always interested in the other side of the wire.
Yeah, we have the list of the casualties from the 1st of July blow and their occupations and names. I couldn't tell you them off the top of my head. But
and why were there so few casualties under the Hawthorne Redoubt? Surely it would have been packed full of German soldiers, wouldn't it, hiding from the artillery barrage?
There's two main reasons for that. One is the redoubt wasn't heavily held.
Yeah.
It was very lightly held because it was more of an observation place.
Okay.
It was built onto the front line. The front line is actually just behind the ridge.
Behind it, yeah.
It's in the field behind.
Yeah.
And a misconception sometimes is people think the front line and then say the first line and then the second line are like 50 yards apart. They're not. The second main line is 1,000 yards away.
Yeah, like that. Yeah.
You have a front line system, and a system is your front line, your support line, your reserve line. So their main occupation were in the support and reserve lines, which is sort of 50, 100 yards behind the front line. So they can still what's going on, and if any attack comes, they can be in the front line in seconds. So it was very lightly held. Some of the casualties came from dugouts collapsing, obviously from debris collapsing in on them, but they were so deep, you know, some of these were 30, 40 feet deep.
Yeah.
So even with debris would only go partway down the shaft and ultimately they'd be able to dig themselves out.
So did the tunnel stop short then of where it was intended?
It was short. It was about 150 feet short, we reckon.
That's
because it only actually took the nose of the redoubt off.
Yeah.
And that was because of when they were digging the tunnel, they were making really good progress, and they got about two thirds of the way across, to about 900 feet. It says in the tunneling company that was doing it, 252's war diary, that they hit a seam of flint. They'd been going through chalk and they hit flint, and it slowed them down. So
they wouldn't have known that, would they, until they got there?
No. And again, flint is very hard.
Yeah.
So you're instantly slowed down. It makes a lot more noise when you try to take it out.
Of course, yeah.
You're only a couple of hundred feet away from the front line. So they'd be able to hear everything.
It's chalk until that stage.
It's chalk up until there, quiet. Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of when they started digging, they only started digging the tunnel in April, and they were going 35 feet a day, which is a lot. That's going some. Is that? That's quite rapid in tunneling.
And who were these people? Were they professional miners, like at Loch Na Garr?
They were, 252 Tunnelling Company, Royal Engineers. Yeah. So they were tunnellers, they were miners, they were diggers. Yeah. So they hit this seam of flint, and they had to take a decision then: do we try and keep going, but we're running out of time? Yeah. Because there's a deadline, you know, we know when the attack's going to start.
Yeah.
So they took a decision to dogleg it. So they went slightly off to the left in the hope that they'd go round it, and they did. They got round the seam of flint. But in doing that, they didn't have enough time to go.
Yeah.
So the ultimate tunnel was 1,050 feet, where it should have been about 1,200 feet, in which case it'd have been right in the middle of the redoubt, and it would have caused a lot more damage. Right.
Yeah.
But it didn't. So
I wonder if there'd have been a different story that day. Probably not, then, because they would have still had all those reserves in the support lines that could have moved forward and still used the lip and still cut down the Royal Fusiliers and the Middlesex men. It would have been the same, wouldn't it?
Yeah, pretty much, because the plan was still the same and the barrage was still the same. And that was one of the key things, was the artillery barrage. The minute the mine went up, which, remember, it went up 10 minutes earlier than the other ones.
That was my next question. Why?
20 past seven, yeah.
Why on earth, when you got, 18, 19 mines that were being blown that day, all being blown at 7:28, why blow this one at 7:20, 8 minutes? Surely that's going to tell everyone within about 20 miles what's coming.
Well, it pretty much did, yeah. that and the fact that the artillery stopped.
Yes.
It stopped on the front line. So it was down to just minimal, you know, so that the Germans had a free run just to get, you know, the debris came down in 45 seconds, you know, whether it was that was what had spooked them, thinking we might get hit by our own debris and stuff like that. But it didn't. And they had a good 10 minutes to get themselves there.
Didn't I read somewhere that this was a compromise because somebody wanted to blow it 4 hours earlier? Somebody wanted to blow. So they've actually compromised at 7:20, which surely is the worst thing you can do in warfare.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's even been mentioned that somebody talked about blowing it the day before.
Well, yeah.
And occupying it and then doing. But and in hindsight, the blowing it three or four hours earlier perhaps would have been a good thing to do, because that's what they did in November and it worked.
Mm, of course it did.
They blew it in darkness.
Yeah.
Completely unawares.
Yeah.
And the second one, they didn't blow under anything. It was actually in no man's land. It didn't take any trenches out. It just filled them in. But it was a disruption. It was a shock thing.
Well, it paved the way for success, didn't it?
That's what it did. Yeah. It was that change from destruction to disruption. It was, you know, which is what the artillery did similarly. You know, They did learn from it. But
I think that's a message that I've been trying to put over in these podcasts, that first of all, is we talked at the start when we were off air, we talked about trying to get people to understand that mistakes were made on the Somme, but we're looking at them with 100 years of hindsight. Try and imagine yourself making those decisions there with all the political and military pressures on your back. I forgot what I was going to say now. Oh, yeah, about artifacts. You said about artifacts. Have you actually, can you describe any artifacts that you found in the crater at all?
To be honest, very little. Very little.
Because it's all been cleared, or maybe it was just destroyed.
I think over the years, there's been various, people have been in, and various unscrupulous people have been in and removed stuff, as is, you know, and still going on today. It just happens. But you've also got to remember that this site, because of it being blown once and then blowing a second time, so a lot of the crater floor is not the natural crater floor.
It's
a lot deeper because all the blow from the second,
it's the spoil from the second,
spoil from the second,
on top of the first,
went on top of the first, exactly. And the second crater isn't as now isn't as wide as it would have been. It goes into the field about a good 10 yards.
Yards. Yeah, I remember you telling me that. Yeah, I mean,
a lot of it's false pushing, you know, from 100 years of farming.
People are going to be listening to that, and they're going to be obvious that I've been there and met you and seen the crater before and after. But a lot of people that are listening to this have never been to the Somme, but are planning to go to the Somme now in the next few months. Can they actually visit the crater then and see all this? And I know you're out there at various times and you do tours, but when you're not there, can people just simply turn up and go and look at the crater? And how easy is that?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's anybody can go at any time, have a walk round. There's a designated path now. And we have a designated marked out path down into the crater, whereas before people were just going in at any point and sliding down the banks, and that wasn't helping it, but that was the only way to see it. So you can get in, you can see it all now, you can see in the bottom, you can get a lot better perspective of it. But when we were out in July, we now have a little guide leaflet that you can pick up in the various visitor centres. There are Avril's at Ocean Villas, they're at Tiet Val, they're at Ulster Tower, they're at the museum in Albert.
Okay.
Go in and get one of these little leaflets. It's just a little fold out and it just gives you a brief history and a little tour around the crater, and it'll give you little bits of history as you walk around to give you an idea of what went on and what you're looking at.
We can perhaps get one of those, and I'll put them on my website so people can have a link to that.
Yeah, I'll send you the
I'll get that image of it. That's like a self-guided tour then, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just because, like I say, we'll give anybody tours at any point if we're there for free. You know, we just do that because we're a charity. We do it. We don't charge for anything. We don't charge for getting out there. We don't charge for accommodation or travel. We do it because we love the place. It's, you know, we treat it as ours. It's not ours, but we are its guardians.
Yeah, that's the phrase that we often use, isn't it, about anything on the Western Front. And about the association, can people actually join it then and contribute themselves financially?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, if you go on to, we have a website, hawthornridgeca.com. Go on there, you can donate through there. You can contact me direct as a secretary. I can give you the details for transferring or donating. We ask for a minimum a £20 donation now, and once you've paid that, you're in. You'll be on a list, a mailing list. If you want to donate more, we are grateful of anything, because we are a charity, and all the funds go back into the site, maintaining it. We're putting a couple of information boards at the bottom of the path.
Yeah.
We don't want to put a lot of things on the site. We want to keep it as natural as possible. But we are aware that when people go and visit it, they need some information when they get there. And just to sort of get your sort of bearings of where you are and what was going on. But yes, please do get in touch. Like I say, either through the website, or you can get in touch with me. You can put my details on either my Twitter name or my Hawthorne email.
What's your Twitter handle again? Tell people what your Twitter handle is.
My Twitter handle is at Great War Nerd.
Great War Nerd. Fantastic.
Yeah, that's me. Look me up. Yeah. Drop us a line, give us a follow, and I'll follow you back. And if you've any further questions about anything, I'm happy to, we're all happy to answer.
You sure are. You know, I've often when I'm taking small parties over to the crater, I've brought them up to see you. And you know, if one of the three or four of you there, then we're often there for an hour or so, aren't you?
Easily.
You're finding stuff out. Every time I go and see you there, you're showing me something or telling me something that I've not heard about before, because you're finding out stuff all the time.
That's it. And we can we always put out on Twitter through the association Twitter feed when we're going to be out there or anybody's going to be out there.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants a tour, you know, you can just drop us a line and we'll meet you and take you around.
And I think
just for a donation, if you can, you know, we'd appreciate it. So,
and I think what's also fascinating, before you even look at the craters, when you get to the top of the path, I always say to people, now turn round and look back into the sunken lane. And look back across the valley as well. And that's the view that the Germans had of the Lancashire Fusiliers, the Royal Fusiliers and the Middlesex men that were coming across that wide expanse of no man's land. What chance did they have?
I know. Well, you know, none, to be honest. And, you know, even going back and researching it and saying, you know, well, what happened? Was it unfortunate? Did this, that and the other? It was that area to me was never going to work.
Shot at, not just from in front, but from either side as well. And also
It's context around the area. It's not just the crater itself.
No, it's
which then tell the story of how it all fits into everything else.
That's right. Because you can see the Stanham Park as well from there.
And beyond. Answers other questions to why it didn't work.
But what people must do before they go is to go onto YouTube and look at the film that Malins took, not just of the crater going up, which is probably one of the most famous 10 seconds of film that there is about World War One. But then he swung his camera around and you can see the Royal Fusiliers going across No Man's Land. And you then can see him coming back, crawling back, can't you?
Yeah, you can. And Andy's done a lot of work on this, on his Ghosts on the Somme book.
Yeah.
We can put explanations to what happens in in that footage.
That's another podcast, that is, isn't it? We'll have to do another podcast.
It is, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
Right. So just to finish, obviously, thanks very much for this, Rick. But when we've been talking off air, you mentioned that it's an exciting new venture that you're putting together with some pals. Did you call it Western Front Services? Tell us about it.
Western Front Services Limited. Yeah, we it's going to be a new business between myself, Terry and Colin, two guys out of Hawthorne. It's not Hawthorne linked. It's a completely separate thing. Yeah. But we met through Hawthorne.
Yeah.
And we get on really well, and we decided to put this together.
So you've got three lively characters here doing this, haven't you?
Yeah, very lively characters, but with bags and bags of experience.
Yeah.
That have been out on these battlefields for as long as I have as well, you know, lots of experience. And it's similar to what you do and other people do, you know. We do battlefield tours. We've both myself and Colin have been doing that for a number of years, independently. But we also and alongside, you know, there's genealogy, there's research,
all the stuff,
talks. We'll go out and give talks to whoever, anywhere, on various all-encompassing subjects of both world wars. Colin has quite an experience of the Second World War too. But one of the main things we want to try and promote is that we can offer archaeological support, particularly out on the Western Front and particularly in France, should it be required, because there isn't anything in place there like there is in Belgium, where the great archaeologist Simon Verdigham works through his company that go out and do pre-construction archaeology. Up in Flanders.
If someone's building a supermarket in Belgium,
then
he's got the right, Simon's got the right, goes in, does the archaeology, but nothing.
Yeah.
Simon doesn't go into France and do that, does he?
And the government pay for that in Belgium. they pay for him to go in, or they arrange with whoever's doing the construction work has to pay for archaeology as part of the project. And there isn't anything like that in France. They can pretty much just go and dig and build and do what they want.
They have done, haven't they? At the cost of battlefields.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it is their land, and that's what we fought to give them back. And I understand that, but there is, you know, it's more what they might find or what we might never find if they just go ahead and do it. And we all know what that is. So we can put together and supply a team of experts through our many contacts to go out and do these things.
That's
whether it's through the World Graves Commission or whether it's through private enterprise or whatever.
That's really exciting then. So, and you're hoping that's going to be up and running soon?
Yeah, we're just designing the website as we speak. So this is the first real live announcement of what we're going to be doing.
Oh, right.
We
do exclusive, have a exclusive yeah. Carols from the Battlefields podcast.
We do have a Twitter page, but yep. Obviously there's been nothing. We first muted this just at the beginning of first lockdown.
Yeah.
And then we couldn't do anything for the best part of 2 years. So We're kind of rebooting and making a real push for it again. Oh, this year, really in ready for next year. So watch out for the name.
It's so different, isn't it? And that's what I said when I first started. I thought, why am I doing these podcasts? Partly to tell the stories of the men that fell, partly to tell the story of things like the craters, but also wanted to promote the businesses on the Western Front that needed support, you know, through the crisis, but also supporting new ventures like this. And this is so different to what anything's ever done before. You know, so if it can be of any, I know lots of people be interested in this because people are fascinated
It's I think it's just one of the things that hasn't been covered, and we think we can help that way.
Definitely.
We're not 100% sure what form that's going to take yet.
No, but it will evolve. It will evolve.
You know, it's just taking that plunge and putting yourself. Yeah. We can do this. We can show we can do it.
Yeah,
we've got experienced people who can do it.
Well, we'll find out more about that, and we'll publicise more of that as it goes forward on the podcast.
Watch this space. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
For now, keep up the good work, Rick. Want to say a massive thank you to you and your team. And,
thank you.
We'll see you out there again soon. I'm sure other people will be that are listening to this.
Yeah, do please get in touch. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Derek.
So, just to clarify some of the things that we were talking about during the podcast was the timing of the explosion beneath or close to the Hawthorne redoubt. And to find out exactly what happened with the decision making, I've turned once again to the superb book by Paul Kendall, Somme 1916. And in the book, Paul explains that Lieutenant General Sir Hunter Weston was commanding 8 Corps, and he requested permission to detonate the mine at 0300 hours on the day of the assault. Rawlinson consulted with Major General Harvey, the Inspector of Mines, who was conscious that during the first 2 years of the war, the British Army had not successfully captured a crater and that German forces were quicker at seizing opportunities. And it was Harvey, therefore, decided that 0 hour was the appropriate time to detonate the mine. Haig and Rawlinson settled upon a compromise with Hunter Weston, allowing the mine to detonate at 7:20. And that's what we said during the podcast, that they actually compromised on the time, which of course led to the terrible disaster that occurred, because it gave the Germans 10 minutes to recover, get their machine guns out of their deep dugouts and mow down the Royal Fusiliers that were approaching across no man's land. Paul's book also goes on to explain that actually 120 men or thereabouts of the 2nd Royal Fusiliers avoided the guns of the Germans and reached the crater, and they very briefly held the ground around the crater. And as they reached the crater, they discovered one of the dugouts that had 4 entrances, but 3 of them had been blocked by the tons of fallen debris. Then they found there was a small hole in the 4th entrance, and there was a sentry that was trying to enlarge this so that the Germans could escape into the trench. This sentry was bayoneted by a soldier from the 2nd Royal Fusiliers, and that German fell dead down the stairs of the dugout. Another German soldier standing next to the sentry fired a flare through the hole and into the face of the British soldier that was holding the bayonet. This action brought swift retribution as they threw Mills bombs through the same hole, and the Germans had to withdraw deeper into the dugout to escape the oncoming blast. One of the German soldiers is quoted in Paul's book, and this is what he said. He said, "The English had managed to break into our trench. We'd only just opened the exit of the dugout when they were upon us. A bayonet thrust killed the man who was holding the shovel. His body fell down the stairs of the dugout, tearing the men that were in the process of getting out again. I had no rifle with me, but managed to fire a signal flare into the face of one of the attackers. The English answered by throwing some hand grenades, which forced us to withdraw." It was then the turn of the 1st Battalion of the Royal Dublin Fusiliers to attack, and they eventually reached their own British front line, and its commander, Lieutenant Colonel H. Nelson, was faced with this desperate situation, finding that most of the battalion that he was to have supported was still actually in the front line, and the wire in no man's land remained intact. And Nelson is quoted as saying, "Eventually, most of the battalion did manage to reach the front trench to find that parties of the Royal Fusiliers were still in it. Utter chaos prevailed. Looking over the parapet, one could see the wire entanglement uncut and the various passengers through it choked with the bodies of the dead and wounded." Now, he's not talking about the German wire. He's talking about the British wire. So before they've even got through their own wire, they've been cut down by the German machine guns firing from the lip of the Hawthorne crater. The casualty figures for the 2nd Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers that advanced directly upon Beaumont Hamel and the crater are absolutely horrendous. Nearly 500 men from that battalion were casualties that day, including 27 of their 29 officers. Just two officers, both company commanders, were the only ones that came out of action that day completely unscathed. And I've had a look on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records on their website because I wanted to see how many of those nearly 500 casualties were actually killed, and the figure is 167. 79 of those men that died do have a grave and are buried in some of the cemeteries around Beaumont Hamel, and the other 88 of them are lost forever. They have no known grave and they are remembered on the Tietvale Memorial. But that wasn't the end of the story, because as we know, other battalions went in following the Royal Fusiliers and the Royal Dublin Fusiliers, and one of those battalions was the 16th Middlesex, and there was a Captain Eric Hall. And once again, Paul Kendall's book tells us what happened to Captain Eric Hall, because he was among the wounded that were lying in no man's land. And this is what he said: "I was taken prisoner about 5 p.m. on the evening of July the 1st, 1916. I'd been lying out there all day since 7:45 a.m. in the morning and unable to move as I was wounded in the knee. About 5 o'clock, the Germans put up a white flag with a red cross and sent three Red Cross men out to collect the wounded. These men were armed with revolvers. All this took place about 80 yards in front of the German first trench at Beaumont Hamel. After being carried in by four of our men, I was taken on a stretcher by two German Red Cross men to a dressing station in the village, where, after an hour or two, I was attended to by a doctor who dressed my wound and gave me a glass of wine." Now, Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton Hall, who was commanding the 16th Middlesex, he saw a white flag of truce being flown from the German lines earlier that afternoon, but he wasn't so sure about the intentions of the enemy. And this is what he said: "About 2:30 p.m. the enemy raised a white flag on his front line and sent over stretcher bearers to no man's land. In addition to helping our wounded, he no doubt was helping himself to the machine guns, Lewis guns and rifles, etc., that were lying about close to his front line. This was reported to the brigade by telephone and permission requested to send out our stretcher bearers to bring in our wounded. Permission was refused, and instead instructions were issued to fire on the enemy's stretcher bearers. These instructions were not acted on with any enthusiasm by our riflemen in the front line." And what this tells us is that at times the men on the front line were actually prepared to disobey orders, because it was against human nature, it was against their own rules of humanity to actually fire on those stretcher bearers when they were actually collecting up their own mates that were lying out there in no man's land. It was morally wrong, that's what they considered. And they knew the right thing to do was to allow those Germans to continue with their work unmolested by rifle or machine gun fire. Unfortunately, the British artillery then shelled the front and support lines that were actually held by the 16th Middlesex in error. And it took Hamilton Hall 20 minutes to persuade the Brigade HQ to call off the barrage. So we know that some of those dead that day must have been killed by the British artillery. And throughout the afternoon, when there wasn't a truce in place, bored German riflemen shot at the British wounded that were lying in no man's land at Beaumont Hamel, where today we visit, and it's such a peaceful setting, it's such a beautiful part of the Somme with the rolling hills and valleys. And when you stand there today at the Hawthorne Crater, it is as usual, absolutely impossible to imagine the hell that those men went through on the 1st of July 1916. So once again, I'd like to thank you for taking the effort to download this podcast and listen to it. I hope you enjoyed it and it gave you the impetus to go and visit the Somme and the Hawthorne Crater, and maybe even join the Hawthorne Ridge Crater Association and become actively involved in the preservation of that site. The next podcast will be in about 10 days. It's going to coincide with the date of the 15th of September, because it will be the 106th anniversary of the Battle of Fleurs Corselet, which was an action that took place within the Battle of the Somme. And what I've done is recorded an interview with a historian and a battlefield guide called Peter Smith, who actually lives today in the village of Fleurs. And he's going to explain to us how tanks were used by the New Zealanders to attack the German defences in the village that he now lives. So that will be coming out, as I say, to coincide with the anniversary of that battle. And one other thing I keep forgetting to ask people to do is that if you get this podcast from Apple, if you wouldn't mind going on to the Apple website or the place where you download it, and you can actually leave a review there. I keep forgetting to do this, but apparently it does help spread the word. It helps promote the podcast and it allows other people to find out about it and tune in. But that's it for this week. Thank you, as I said again, for tuning in. Hopefully you'll all be getting out to the Somme over the next few weeks before the weather turns. And what I'd like to do, as usual, is pay my respects to all of the men from the British and the German army that fell in and around the Hawthorne Crater in the two actions in July and November of 1916. And we're going to do that by playing The Last Post.